HIV FM 102.3. This show is Good Morning Comrade. You can listen every Tuesday on WHIVFM.org, 102.3 in New Orleans area. You can also check out goodmorningcomrade.com/listen for WHIVFM.org/listen, to listen anywhere in the world. All more information at goodmorningcomrade.com. So today we have a professor of Democratic and Justice Studies, John Shelton. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey K connected us, and he got back to me really quickly. So thanks a lot for good communication leading up to this.
Yeah, no. Harvey's a very close friend of mine. So if Harvey suggests I get in touch with somebody, I do it. I've learned not to not take his advice.
And don't take his advice. That's good.
Good to be here. And looking at myself in this the preview picture, I'm seeing that I'm finally noticing how overdue for a haircut I am. There's going to be some people with some crazy looking hair in a few months, I think.
Oh yeah, I've seen a lot of these pictures of people who are cutting their own hair, or getting their spouse to cut their hair, or they're cutting their kids' hair, all that kind of stuff. It's really funny.
Yeah, the best image there is our Green Bay mayor. His name's Eric Genrich, and he's a friend of ours, my wife and I. And he posted a picture on Facebook with his, 7-year-old daughter cutting his hair.
Yeah. So. Oh, that's cute. That's fun.
It was really cute, but yeah, that's where we're headed, I think. All of us.
So, you have a book that came out. But when exactly did Teacher Strike come out?
It came out in 2017. Mm-hmm. Since I'm homebound, I happen to have a copy of it.
Oh, look at that!
Show you. It came out in 2017.
Cool. And the sort of thrust of the book is the teacher strikes that have happened sort of historically within the U.S. Leading up to and including the ones from the last couple of years, or the ones at least in the run up to that.
Yeah. So
next sort of rash.
The big red, the wave of teacher strikes that's happened in the past couple of years that really started in 2018.
Yeah, that's right.
So I don't really cover most of that in my book. I touch a little bit on the 2012 CTU strike,
which
was really, really, really important, precursor to this wave of strikes. But it was fascinating because my book had been out for, just maybe like 6 months. And I was doing a talk. I had a talk, a friend of mine set up a talk for me in New York. At the Joseph Murphy Institute. And the day before the talk was set up, West Virginia teachers went on strike.
Oh, wow.
So there probably would have been like three people there at the talk had that not happened. But, of course, the West Virginia strike got national attention. Mm-hmm. And the room, it was just a conference room in a high rise in New York, it was totally packed. There were like 35 people there. So we can talk a little bit more about, the argument of my book in a second. But like, it was really, really great to have a book titled Teacher Strike right when that wave of strikes happened, because, I had like a 15 minutes of scholarly fame, I guess, where I had all these media asking me for the historical context.
Yeah. That's great. So that's perfect.
It was a really, really kind of nice moment, actually.
Mm-hmm. And we have had, if you want to go deep into our archives, the show is less than a year old at this point, but one of our first interviews was with Eric Blanc, who wrote the book Red State Revolt on the subject. We talked to him about that.
Book.
Yeah.
Book. I know Eric a little. He's a really smart guy.
Yeah. I met him. He came up here and did a little talk on the book, and on sort of the strikes, last spring, summer, like really the end of May. So it was really great of him to see that, and that we kind of hit it off.
He's done such a good job. I'm seeing the Bernie sign in your background. He's done such a good job with the Bernie circuit too.
Right.
Maybe even more impressive than the work he did in the book.
Right. Yeah. And it's speaking of Bernie, I guess we could talk about the Sanders campaign if you'd like, and then we can, or we could start with your book. It's up to you.
Let's talk about the book, and then we can move into the Bernie stuff. If you
okay.
Want.
So
the Bernie stuff's kind of a sad note at the moment. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Let's make it. let's leave him crying. So anyway, the I guess to sort of frame this, I'm a teacher in Jefferson Parish. Most listeners would know that, but Jefferson Parish is right next to Orleans Parish, which has a very strong history of a teachers union in New Orleans. And since that was pre-Katrina and post-Katrina, that was sort of changed. But in Jefferson Parish, we also have a American Federation of Teachers local called Jefferson Federation of Teachers. And a lot of the people who have been involved in JFT for a very long time, they always do tend to talk about, oh, I was a strike captain in 79 when we held the line, you know, that kind of stuff. And that sort of like really rings true when it comes to the sort of historical framing. And I guess you could provide some context with your book and sort of in your studies with that.
Yeah. And so, you know, the 1970s, you said it, you know, you said it exactly right. I mean, you know, you do have this sort of like oral tradition of, you know, teacher strikes from the 70s that people draw on. And the reason for that is because, you know, the 1970s really were the era of teacher strikes in the United States, right? So like, I'm not sure how many people make that connection. When I talk to people about the book, they're always astounded when I talk about the number of strikes that existed. And mm-hmm. in fact, you know, one way to kind of get at this may be to talk about how I ended up writing this book. So I was a grad student, and I was really interested in this question of how is it that the United States becomes conservative in the basically, you know, how do you explain Reagan, but even beyond that, the bigger kind of forces that brought us Reagan, right?
Right.
And so I was looking for, you know, I felt like scholars hadn't really answered that question sufficiently. And when I was looking around, you know, I was going through a whole bunch of different ideas. At one point I thought I might write about Major League Baseball and the Players Association, because there's some fascinating stuff there actually. You know, Kurt Flood and the fight for free agency and how that impacted bigger American politics. But when I was looking at newspapers in the 70s, I just kept coming across all of these examples of teacher strikes, right? And so, you know, I would read a little bit more into them. And one of the things I noticed is that, you know, as I kind of track them, you know, I don't know if any of your listeners have done anything with microfilm, but like when you're going through newspapers on microfilm, it can be kind of boring, but you can also track things over the long haul rather than just doing a keyword search. So I'm going through all these newspapers, newspaper after newspaper, and I'm noticing that so many of these strikes were more than just like a day or two, right? They were weeks, they were months. In some cases, you know, some of the longer strikes, there were strikes in Philadelphia in 1972, 73. There was a strike that actually lasted, there were two parts, but it lasted 3 months, right?
Wow.
So you think about some of the recent actions that we've had, which, I mean, the last strike in Chicago, what was that, about 10 days?
Yeah.
Something along those lines. I mean, imagine the school district being shut down in a major city, you know, for 2 months, 3 months. And the fascinating thing about it is when I looked at what people were talking about, I mean, this is front page news every day. There were a million letters to the editor. I started looking more into it, and I noticed that, like, a lot of people you know, when these strikes were happening, were writing letters into, like, mayors and mm-hmm. city council members and school board members and stuff. And the more that you look at it, the more that I looked at it, the more I realized that so many of the conversations were about more than just, you know, the kind of immediate labor conflict, right? Like the salaries for teachers and class size and those kinds of things. They were about what's the legitimate role of labor unions in a society?
Mm-hmm.
Should public employees be able to strike?
Yeah.
How does this connect to racial politics in the city? How does this connect to a city's ability to pay for all the services that it needs? So we just ended up, when I looked at these, I realized that like there was something here that I needed to look at,
mm-hmm.
and I needed to look at what was going on. How were people thinking about all these big things through the context of these teacher strikes?
Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting too. If you go back and listen to our episode that we did with Kenzo Shibata about the teacher strike that happened in Chicago. Kenzo's a member of the executive board on, I'm sorry, he was on the bargaining team. I don't want to get messed up in the details, but he was kind enough to talk with us. I met him up in Chicago because I was able to go and visit during that strike and show a little bit of solidarity from New Orleans. But he kind of laid out a lot of that, those same kinds of things. They were fighting for nurses and social workers and things that were technically not allowed to fight for according to either state or city agreement. They were not allowed to fight for those things. They're only allowed to argue for salaries, but they were able to sort of get the community on side and kind of be able to push the limits of what they were officially asking for, along with what they were also trying to get provided for. Part of it was housing too, which was really interesting.
Right, and I would say that the historical context, what makes what Chicago teachers, you know, really kind of pioneered in 2012 and then deepened this past fall, was a real commitment to bargaining for those sorts of things, right? And that's a departure from actually most of the teacher strikes that I document in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So those strikes ended up actually dividing communities. And I'm not blaming teachers for that.
Sure.
There were like real structural reasons that was the case, right? But they ended up dividing. They ended up dividing communities in a way that, you know, the more recent wave of teacher strikes hasn't, right? So these strikes, I think, more recently have been so much more effective because they've clearly gotten the public on their side by linking the needs of teachers with the needs of the community.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, most teacher strikes, really were kind of battled over one of three things, right? One, whether or not teachers should have the right to collectively bargain and whether they should have the right to even go on strike,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, you have to remember that those things hadn't been accepted. And so teachers had to fight for those things really vigorously in the 1960s. So in a lot of cases, you had, you know, say, you know, parents and taxpayers in various cities who said, okay, we believe that teachers should make more money, but they shouldn't be allowed to go on strike, right? They because that's too disruptive to, you know, our kids' morals, actually, is one of the things that they would talk about. So for that reason, you know, you kind of have this, like, you know, real sort of division that already exists. Those are actually most of the strikes that take place in the 60s. When you get to the end of the 60s and into the early 1970s, teachers who had just won these collective bargaining rights, which included due process rights, which mm-hmm. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, right? I mean, before teachers had unions, it was really common for school administrators, you know, to basically lay off teachers for really any reason. So
at will employment, basically.
Yeah, it was pretty close to it in a lot of places. It's a little more complicated because,
sure,
you know, some places had tenure systems that actually predated unions, but they could basically shift them around. They could move them to other schools without really asking them. So in the late 60s, there's a sort of confluence of two things. You've got civil rights activists in cities like New York, Newark, Detroit, and other places who legitimately were upset at the very slow pace of doing something about the unequal conditions for white and black students. And so one of the ways that they sought to change things was to give African-American communities more control over the school districts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in places like New York, where like 90% of the teaching force was white, what that meant was a conflict between due process rights and, you know, these you know, legitimate reasons to ask for more community control.
Right.
So you have a series of really divisive conflicts there. And then as we get later into the 70s, I'm sure a lot of your listeners already know something about this. The 1970s, there was a whole series of economic crises, right,
mm-hmm.
related to inflation, energy crisis, related to companies moving industry outside of major cities, in some cases to suburbs, but in some cases to the U.S. South, in some cases even to the global South, right? So
largely deindustrialization. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but it's sort of like a pivot away from production. This happened through the 90s, as a mode of sort of like anchor of the economy.
Yeah, yeah. So exactly. So you have cities like New York, which are, you know, really reliant, not totally reliant, but to some extent reliant on, say, the garment industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those jobs, companies start to move for cheaper
shipped
labor,
overseas,
you know, in the 60s and 70s. You know, so what does that do to, say, the tax base, right?
Mm-hmm.
Also, what happens when middle class people and professional class people move out of the city? They still work in the city, right? So they're still using it, but they're living in the suburbs and taking their property taxes to the suburbs.
Right.
So cities like New York and others come under tremendous fiscal pressure. Philadelphia is another one that comes under tremendous fiscal pressure in the 70s. And so public employees, but especially teachers, become really central to these battles by conservative, in some cases Democrat, but in some cases conservative politicians to you know, kind of rein in taxes and rein in expenditures and deal with the problem of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So and those in particular, those sort of conflicts over fiscal crises, I mean, New York almost goes bankrupt in 1975. It's actually the teacher's pension in New York that bails the city out largely. Oh,
you're welcome.
Right. But teachers are still blamed for, you know, their exorbitant salaries, supposedly like bankrupting the city. So you have this like wedge between public employees and private sector workers in the 1970s. So I talk a lot about that in my book. And you can really see the seeds of Reagan there, right? So like while New York is going, is like within a couple of days of you know, literally defaulting and going bankrupt in November 1975, Reagan, who's running as a conservative to Ford's right in the Republican primary, is like, you know, going on television and saying, the real victims in all of this are the taxpayers, the private sector
right.
workers who are being exploited by public employees and politicians who have basically been lying to them. So you can see the playbook all the way back in, you know, the 1970s. And, you know, one of the things I show in the book is that, you know, teachers through no fault of their own end up at the middle of these. And to really understand how the U.S. becomes conservative, we got to understand that story.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This show is called Good Morning Comrade, and get more information at goodmorningcomrade.com. You know, that's interesting that you bring that up and to bring it Reagan. I'm not sure if you're familiar with an author named Rick Perlstein, who wrote
sure,
a series
yeah.
of books on the sort of, he sort of frames the that period of history from the 1960s all the way through. I've read through his first two on Goldwater and Nixon. And then he goes on to move to Reagan and then later even Clinton. But I don't know, the central argument that he sort of makes is that these people sort of came with an ideological strain of conservatism, and it's sort of able to, they're sort of parlay that even through losses, like into the new status quo, and sort of like realign what the sort of like political playing field is. Is that sort of play into what you're talking about as well? And
yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, I'm a big admirer of Perlstein's books.
Mm-hmm.
They get longer and longer.
They do. They're pretty hefty.
The first one, Before the Storm, that's the one about Goldwater, I think is, that was really actually influential on me when I was in grad school. He's a terrific writer. I think where Perlstein and I, you know, obviously we're talking about a similar story, but I think, you know, there's a distinction in terms of what we're emphasizing. So, you know, for Perlstein, I think what he's, you know, basically arguing is what we're trying to point out is the role that conservative politicians play in driving that wedge between different groups of people in the United States, political gain. The Goldwater book doesn't quite do so much, but the book about Nixon and then of course the one about Reagan in particular, they, you know, that's, he does a really nice job of documenting that. I think where my work would be sort of complementary to that is by talking about how, you know, what's the sort of terrain in which those politicians are operating, right?
So right.
If you talk to Americans in, you know, working Americans in the 1930s, 40s, you know, 50s even, and you basically told them that unions were the problem, you know, they would say, you're crazy. You know, we can
yeah.
remember what things were like during the Depression. We know how unions had basically like revolutionized their lives and given us more economic security. But when you get to the 1970s, right, and you've got people like Reagan making that argument, they find more fertile ground because of these, you know, because of the trajectory of American politics and especially American urban politics, right?
Right.
So this real failure, and again, teachers get caught up in it, but this real failure to rectify the significant and we can't underestimate how significant they are, that the gross injustices that were done to African Americans throughout mm-hmm. American history, but like really manifested in after World War II, you know, the inability for, you know, the American political system to solve those problems, right, gave conservative politicians terrain, like Nixon, for example, to exploit those tensions that existed. And Reagan does it, you know, with the, you know, sort of American political system's inability to continue to ensure economic security for one in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so there was sort of so the argument was not necessarily made by Nixon, not necessarily one that was like explicitly about like doing a racism or whatever, but there was a sort of couching in the framing of those anxieties that existed in those spaces. Is that sort of what you're talking about?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that Reagan did, and of course he wasn't the only one, but he was the one who probably did it best in the 70s and 80s, is, you know, one of the things that a lot of conservatives talked about that helped them to kind of change American politics, and I mean this obviously in a detrimental way, one of the things they were able to do is they talked about basically like who are the productive people in American society and who were the unproductive people. And so one of the like rhetorical things they did, and if you read the book, you'll see there's plenty of evidence for this, both from Reagan and from like ordinary people who had, you know, been supporters basically of like New Deal Democrats and then kind of turned against them, is they argued that like, you know, it was private sector employees, taxpayers who were the real productive people in society. Mm-hmm. And they kind of rhetorically linked, right? So when they talked about them, they linked them together. Welfare recipients and public sector workers, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, these are both groups that are drains on society and they're exploiting institutions that exist in order to benefit themselves. And so what they would argue is what we really need to do to get back on track is we need to discipline unions. We need to eliminate welfare programs or at least reduce them. And if we can do that, that will make the U.S. economically and politically prosperous again.
Right.
And, you know, that's been the playbook since the 1970s, really, for conservatives.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, because it's almost like you're taking taxpayers and you're taking public sector employees and you're taking welfare recipients and putting them into three discrete buckets as though there's no overlap, because there could be a teacher who receives welfare, you know, who has also got a second job in the private sector. Right. I mean, these things are not really, they're not just completely discrete entities, I suppose. But framing it in these discrete terms are, in a rhetorical sense, is sort of like what was being pushed forward.
Exactly. And you know, and they're also based largely on fictions, right? So like, you know, Reagan would often talk about, you know, about welfare queens, you know, who were riding around in Cadillacs, mm-hmm. but they were based on fantasy, right? They were conservative fantasy. Exactly. Yeah. They're basically these fantasies to be used for, you know, polemical purposes to mm-hmm. undercut, you know, the programs that existed. And really beyond that to delegitimize the real structural problems that existed in American mm-hmm. society, right? I mean, African Americans disproportionately in the 60s and 70s and 80s were living in cities where there weren't jobs, right? So mm-hmm. like no amount of, you know, moral discipline or, you know, attempting to improve the education system would have changed the economic reality for African American communities in places where, you know, all the industries and all the jobs had moved, you know, a decade before.
Right. And so I suppose the question would then become that would be where you come in and sort of like fill in the blanks for like what the groundwork was for like where the unions and where the sort of like workers were at during this, specifically the education and teacher unions.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I argue is, you know, I think a lot of teacher unions in the 60s and 70s, they did the best that they could. Mm-hmm. They were dealing with, you know, one of the problems is that, again, they were pretty new unions. We mm-hmm. sometimes forget that, you know, like the first collective bargaining contract for teacher unions in the U.S. was in 1961 or 62, the United Federation of Teachers in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the next few years, right, like other unions starting big cities, but then, you know, expanding into suburbs and even rural areas, you know, they start to get collective bargaining contracts as well. But in terms of being like institutionally stable, most unions, that doesn't really happen until at least the end of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have unions that are forced to deal with, all of these structural problems that are outside of their control, segregation and deindustrialization, all these things. And so, I think it's, in retrospect, you know, it's hard to know exactly what they should have done
mm-hmm.
Differently. But I think it's clear that the teacher unions that are successful now and have been successful. One example actually would be the New Orleans teacher union, which did this pretty well, would be to really link the needs of teachers strongly with the needs of students and parents in mm-hmm. a way that didn't divide people and gets everybody pulling in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually where I actually end the book by talking about how, you know, the CTU and what they were doing in 2012 was really like the path forward, right? Mm-hmm. And that what unions had to do, teacher unions, what they had to do was really, not allow themselves to get caught up in sort of zero sum fights, but push for the needs of the entire community. And mm-hmm. so I end the book on a really hopeful note, and I'll just point out that I think I've been proven right by pointing to that based on what we've seen in the past, you know, couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Can I focus in just for a moment on one of the particular dynamics to kind of zoom back into sort of like one of the political intersections that exists here is the sort of framing of the nation in crisis, which is something I think about a lot. So the nation in crisis was a report by the Reagan administration that essentially said, well, we are failing our entire society by essentially not educating our kids properly. And
you're referring to a nation at risk.
A nation at risk. I beg your pardon. Yeah. And that sort of was one of the things that started the sort of modern framing of education as a good upon itself and even a replacement potentially for actual resources for families instead of food stamps or whatever, that would replace a strong social safety net. Right. And that seems to be the framing right now to make it the situation a very bootstrapsy kind of culture, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe could you talk a little bit about how that played into, especially the because that happened after most of this action. Can you just sort of explain how that was, how that has been used and how it's developed over the years?
Sure. Yeah. So first thing I would say, and we'll get back to a nation at risk in a second, but the first thing I would say is that, you know, a nation at risk really kind of crystallized a lot of, sort of impulses that were already there. So, you know, it doesn't really come out of nowhere. People had been sort of making that argument about education and, you know, human capital as to overcome structural limitations. In some cases, it was Democrats making that argument.
Oh yeah,
still well do. Before a nation at risk mm-hmm. Was out. Yeah, and actually, you know, this is a nice transition because this is the book project I'm working on now, actually, which looks at basically how Americans think about the connection between education and economic security, economic opportunity over the course of American history.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go back, example, to society, right? I'm sure your listeners know about the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which mm-hmm. you know significantly improved federal funding for public education. And it was
Johnson, right?
Yeah, it was compensatory. The idea was that, you know, we're compensating largely African Americans, but not totally mm-hmm. anyone who was poor. Compensating people for wrongs that had been done to them. But a lot of the assumptions there that were embedded in say like the way that people in Congress talked about it was based on this idea that people who didn't have jobs needed to be made ready for jobs, that they needed to sort of overcome some of their individual deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's complicated, right? Because that also comes with, this funding that goes primarily to impoverished school districts, that comes with all these other reforms, right? Like the expansion the creation of Medicaid and Medicare. So it's not, when that happens, it's not, in other words, it's like there's an effort to help people overcome some of the personal impediments that, you know, policymakers felt like. Sorry, I'm getting a phone call. I need to decline it. So there.
Yeah, I'm good.
I'm getting phone calls every 5 seconds these days.
Yeah.
There was this of policy that would people deficiencies at the same time were, you know, real kind of effort for being society.
John.
Those two things in the 1960s.
Hello?
Yeah.
Lost you again.
You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. What's the last thing you heard?
Just about 5 seconds ago, I can't remember. I'm sorry. You were talking about sort of the LBJ Great Society and
sure.
sort of like the run up of those programs.
So ESEA, right?
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got money that's meant to help overcome the poverty that exists. The discrepancy that exists between spending among school districts. So there's an intervention on the structural level, but at the same time, a lot of the justifications that policymakers, say in Congress make for the necessity of this education policy is that basically poor people need to overcome their individual deficiencies, right? They need to be more sort of ready for the job market.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of a balance between those two things during the Great Society, But by the time you get into the 70s and, the conservatives get more powerful, neoliberal economists like Milton Friedman are more successfully able to kind of jump into this vacuum caused by the economic crisis of the 70s and say that we need these market reforms. By the time you get to the end of the 70s and into the 80s, the situation is really primed for that idea that the way to help people succeed in the economy is to give them the right skills.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is primed for that idea to basically sort of outweigh all of the other sort of, structural problems that, say liberals and Democrats knew and existed and tried to do something about in the 60s and say early 70s. So when you get to a nation at risk, you're absolutely right. It really shines a light on, this growing drive for education reform and
it didn't come out of nowhere.
Hires a lot of people. Yeah, it doesn't come out of nowhere. It does sort of inspire all of these, education reformers to get in, both right and left, to get involved in doing something about the education system. But I would actually equate a nation at risk. I think it's kind of similar to what Reagan did in firing the PATCO workers in 1981. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is, in this sense, when
the
Reagan fired the PATCO workers. Yeah, the air traffic controllers. Yeah, thank you. When Reagan fired the air traffic controllers in 1981, it wasn't the first time that, an employer, even a government employer, had started replacing workers who went on strike. But it was possible because you had more employers starting to think about that as a tactic and use that tactic in the 1970s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when Reagan does it sort of like solidifies this thing that's already in motion and gives it, sort of even more cachet. And so then other people start doing it in the 80s, right? And the story of the 80s is, all kinds of employers, breaking strikes from Hormel to Greyhound, replacing workers. But it's similar.
Hello?
Brings together.
Hello, I'm losing you again.
But then further catalyzes it, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and so I guess the way I would sort of think of that is that it's almost that private industry, or, you know, the private sector viewed that the firing of the Patco workers, and this is not like a revolutionary take or whatever, but essentially they viewed the firing of the Patco workers as sort of like a signal or permission that they could do the same, that they could just fire workers and get away with it because the government's already approved that that sort of approach.
Last thing that I heard was, I just finished sort of talking about the comparison between Patco and A Nation at Risk,
mm-hmm.
and then asking a question.
Oh, I was sort of like contextualizing, I guess, at least, or maybe getting it straight in my mind. So the Patco workers, when they were fired by the president, and, you know, during their strike, that was sort of viewed by the private sector as permission, essentially, for them, or at least protection and cover in a legal sense, that the government would not pursue them for doing the same.
Exactly. I mean, and that was particularly important because, you know, Reagan was really the first president. Even Republicans that came before Reagan, they hadn't like staffed the National Labor Relations Board with people who were like antithetical to unions, right?
Right.
Like, they may have been sort of ideologically not all that happy with the, you know, notion of labor unions, but, you know, even, you know, Eisenhower and Ford, like, you know, Nixon, they staffed the NLRB with, you know, people who actually saw a duty to, you know, kind of uphold the work that they were there to do. Reagan didn't do that. So, you know, in sort of conjunction with the folks he staffed the NLRB with, find the PATCO workers, not that employers necessarily needed any sort of like legal justification, you know, because you're talking about private sector employers, right?
Correct.
What they really needed was sort of like moral justification.
Yeah.
And that's what Reagan, you know, kind of allowed.
Like, yeah. A political cover.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, well, you know, so, you know, now the president has said that unions are basically out of control and asking for too much. That licenses us to do it.
Right.
But, you know, you have to remember that employers were already doing this in mm-hmm. the 1970s.
Right.
There's a great book by a colleague of mine that your listeners might be interested in, called Knocking on Labor's Door by Lane Wyndham.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically, one of the big arguments she makes in the book is that in the 1970s, employers were, you know, already, you know, kind of going to war on unions and trying to circumvent labor law in order to keep people from winning union elections. You know, there's this whole conversation in labor history about like why it is that unions start declining, especially private sector unions in mm-hmm. the 60s and 70s. And what Lane says is actually they continued to try and join unions. There were just as many workers trying to get certification elections in the late 70s as there were at the beginning of the decade, but they just weren't winning as many of them because employers were engaging in, you know, really hard knuckle tactics, mm-hmm. firing organizers, delaying elections, appealing every part of the process in order to prevent workers from getting a collectively bargained contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was double in the public sector. I mean, so because that was when in the public sector there was essentially like a legal precedent for busting unions, and then sort of like after A Nation at Risk, specifically in the education field, that was when there was a change in trajectory and then policy from that Great Society.
Yes, although, you know, for the most part, with a few exceptions, you know, public employers take a harder line with a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, say teacher unions in the 70s, but you never see anything with a few exceptions where anything as drastic as like what happened with, say, Reagan and the air traffic controllers, right?
I mean, mm-hmm. I guess what I mean to say, and I would like to hear your example, but I guess the policy against educators and teachers sort of ramped up, not necessarily in a directly combative way, but the there was sort of a rhetorical shifting and a trajectory change that would be towards more, and it really ramped up with Bush with the emphasis on testing and then emphasis on evaluation, and that's maybe jumping a couple of steps ahead, but I don't know. I just wanted to kind of like justify what I was saying.
No question. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, and that's one of the things I was kind of saying about a nation at risk, right? Is that, you know, in the 70s, especially when you get to the end of the decade, there's this whole series of like reports about what's wrong with American education.
Yeah.
Right. And unions are typically a big part of that, you know, kind of rhetorical case. So, you know, that stuff is definitely happening. That you can find the roots of the like accountability movement in the 70s, right? Like,
yeah.
Because you have like taxpayers saying we're spending all this money and we're not getting better education outcomes.
Right.
Oftentimes when they talk about that, it's like flat out racist, right? It's
right.
Like, why are we spending all this money on these black kids who are never going to be smart enough, you know, never going to learn enough to break out of poverty anyway? I mean, I'm barely exaggerating like what I found when I saw some of these letters.
Mm-hmm.
So the roots are definitely there in the 70s. Absolutely. So if you're trying to think about like, you know, how we get to No Child Left Behind, you'd want to start at least as early as the 1970s, I think.
Okay. That's really interesting, and I guess to go forward to No Child Left Behind from there, I guess, could you take us down that road from a nation at risk, or maybe just maybe define some of that history that you just alluded to?
Sure, yeah. So nation at risk, right, sounds this sort of emergency, right? You know, there's actually a fascinating story behind a nation at risk because you know, the Department of Education, I don't know if your listeners know this, but the Department of Education is actually a really young cabinet department. Aside from Homeland Security, I think, I'm not certain about this, but I'm pretty sure. Aside from Homeland Security, it's the newest cabinet level department.
Yeah.
It was actually passed into law in the Carter administration in 1978 or 79. And, you know, so when Reagan comes into office in the early 1980s, one of the first things he does is says, I want to eliminate government waste, right? I mean, he sort of famously says at his, I believe it's his inauguration speech, government isn't the solution to our problems. Government is the problem.
Yeah.
One of the first things he wants to do is he says, we're going to eliminate the Department of Education. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he really meant there was, yeah, obviously not eliminate the federal presence of education, though he wanted to reduce it, but basically roll it back into another cabinet level department. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It had just been part of housing, education and welfare as recently as, again, the late 70s. It's fascinating. His secretary of education, a guy named Terrell Bell, who had been, you know, he had been the head of the education department back in the 70s when it was called the Office of Education. Terrell Bell was a Republican, but he was basically a liberal Republican from Utah, mm-hmm. I think. And so when Reagan basically goes to him and says, you know, I want you to start works on eliminating the Department of Education. And what Bell does, he writes an autobiography that's actually really great if anyone's interested. He kind of charts how he did this. He basically said, you know, he wanted to stop that from happening. So mm-hmm. he kind of pushed for this, like, you know, study of the education system that ends up being a nation at risk.
Wow.
So a nation at risk, it's interesting. Yeah. So a nation at risk is this, you know, basically call to say there's a national emergency because, you know, the American education system is not as good as it should be.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting about it is it, you know, a nation at risk doesn't actually call for a lot of conservative, you know, kind of, I don't know,
like
the
policy
word is, a lot
recommendations?
Of conservative medicine, right?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. It actually says we need to pay teachers more money. We need to spend more money on teachers. You know, I mean, it does call for some accountability measures.
Sure.
And some of your listeners may know that Albert Shanker, who was president of the AFT, he actually embraced the nation at risk. He said, we need to be a part of these conversations. He was, you know, Shanker was an interesting guy.
Oh yeah.
But so anyway, this A Nation at Risk puts the education outcomes on the political agenda.
Yeah.
And George H.W. Bush in particular, right, says, I want to be the education president. Bill Clinton, a lot of his,
it takes a village or it takes a community to raise a child or something like that. That was the Clinton thing. Exactly, I remember I was in school when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. So they start pitching this sort of national, actually, Bush and Clinton were very similar on kind of what they wanted with education. They start pitching this drive for national standards, right?
Mm-hmm.
Clinton ends up, working with Congress to pass laws developing a set of national goals for education, the Goals 2000 legislation, basically. And so when you get to George W. Bush, right, there's sort of been these like this set of like incremental steps, mm-hmm. arguing for more and more, you know, standards. And then when you get to George W. Bush, right, it's these standards come with more teeth, right?
And, yeah, the big step.
Exactly, like that, right? The testing regime that's tied mm-hmm. to public dollars. But Clinton was calling for many of the same things, actually, right? He was pushing for testing. He just, you know, the idea was a little bit ahead of, you know, the time, I guess. And so he couldn't get, you know, so some of the stronger standards that Bush ended up kind of getting.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really, it's fascinating because, like, you know, up until the past few years, I would say one of the few things that there's been some level of bipartisan consensus around is the idea that, you know, teachers need to be disciplined and there needs to be better, you know, assessment of education outcomes, that we've got to tie dollars to the performance of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's been something of a bipartisan consensus around that, I think.
And charters.
It's coming unraveled now.
Well, thank goodness.
And charters, yeah.
Thank goodness hopefully that bipartisan consensus is unraveling, because it is one of those sorts of things where, I mean, when I think of the way that the education system is structured, I think specifically about like Bill Gates, Eli Broad, and Michael Bloomberg, and and the Walton Family Foundation, who have just tremendous influence over the trajectory of this cabinet level department. They're able to create their studies and programs that, in the long run, they George Bush even admitted that teacher accountability, quote unquote, was a failure. But he that didn't stop him from investing, hundreds of millions of more dollars into it. Let me real quick just pause for station ID. You are listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. We have John Shelton on the show. He is a professor of Democratic and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay. He has a book out 2018 called Teacher Strike. Go ahead and pick it up. So I guess to kind of like push on to that point, the sort of political economy behind the, billionaires able to sort of intellectualize their wealth and use it to push their agenda. How does that work?
Oh boy, that's a big question.
Oh boy.
The place I would start with is this. As many of your listeners know, we have seen a dramatic, maybe unprecedented increase in wealth inequality in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It's really reminiscent of, you know, the Gilded Age. That's the only sort of historical precedent, you know, where you have individuals, you know, through these massive business ventures,
mm-hmm.
with so much money that they literally have so much money they don't know what to do with it, right?
They can't possibly use it all ever in a million years.
So they fantasize that they're going to do some good with it, right? People like Bill Gates and all the others that you mentioned. And what's the easy thing to do with that money if you don't want to actually change the structure of society? Well, especially if we have this bipartisan consensus that public education is the thing that you do to help people overcome poverty and to help them overcome whatever, you know, limits they exist in their own world, right? That if you can't literally have people pick themselves up by their bootstraps, right, which we know mm-hmm. is like literally impossible, then what you can do is arm them, according to this logic, right? Like you can arm them with the capabilities to go out and do better in the job market, right?
Right.
So this is, you know, I'll do a plug for a friend of mine who's working on a book. His name is Neil Krause, and he's basically working on a book right now where he talks about this as being the fantasy economy, basically, right? That like we're fantasizing if we think that, you know, just giving people access to education alone is going to be the thing that, you know, really creates a quality of economic opportunity. But for people like Gates and these other folks, that's what that's attractive to them, because what it allows them to do is think, you know, it allows the society to basically maintain all the power dynamics that already exist, right?
Because right.
If you can just give everybody a quality of opportunity, there's no reason to change everything, right? If you don't go out and get a good job, it's your fault. We gave you the education, right?
And you get to look good doing it.
Oh yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter if, you know, $500 million to Bill Gates is the equivalent of, you know, me spending $20 on giving it to a homeless person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It basically like you know, reinforces the ideology we have in that some people have. I think, again, this is coming undone, but the ideology that a lot of Americans have that, you know, this society is a meritocracy, and if we can just make it more fair, and we don't need to do any of the things that we know we need to do, which is like guaranteeing people healthcare, constructing an education system that does more than just, you know, teach people very narrow tasks, but teaches them how to be citizens, ensuring that everybody has the right to a good paying job. We don't have to do any of those things if we can fantasize that we give them the right education and thus they have the chance. And the other thing I would emphasize is that, you know, all those people you mentioned, with the possible exception of the Waltons, you know, they give money to Democrats, you know, and it's Democratic strongholds like, you know, Chicago and Los Angeles, where the Broad Foundation is really, you know, is really, really spend a lot of money there. You know, it's these places where, that are run by Democrats in some cases that are
New
that
Orleans
are being
on that
along
list.
These market lines, right? It's not Republicans, that or I mean it's not just Republicans.
Correct.
So, I mean, that's why I feel like there's a bipartisan consensus around some of this stuff, right? Uh-huh. I mean, you should read some of the stuff that this is one of the things I'm working on for my book, but some of the stuff that Clinton and the DLC were writing about charter schools in, you know, 1992. In the lead up to, you know, the presidential 91 and 92 in the lead up to the presidential election that year, all the way through, you know, race to the top, the, you know, Obama, Arne Duncan, education policy that basically tied funding that was desperately needed for public education to, you know, proliferation of charter schools and, you know,
generations agenda.
Yeah.
A exactly, generation exactly. worth of an agenda culminated under Obama. That really is a generation of education reform, and then it was just injected with like super steroids after that with Betsy DeVos even. But I mean, again, in terms of like the specific policies that were pursued, not particularly different.
That's right. I mean, the DeVos stuff is now it's a little different because DeVos is also there's the sort of elements of, you know,
religion
in there, right?
Yeah.
So like opening things up to private voucher schools and religious schools, that's something that even a lot of Democrats didn't go there. But you're right, it's basically like market-driven ed reform on steroids.
And so I guess to kind of close, we have, you know, about 5-10 more minutes. I did want to kind of talk a bit about the future of these things. Sort of like, where is education policy going? How do teachers and teachers unions and other community groups factor into that? And we did say we want to talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders. He recently dropped out of the election, but he had a very comprehensive plan that included things like abolition of for-profit charter schools and the banning of non-profit charter schools, the sort of rollback of testing and various things like that. Is that sort of vision, at least, I guess, potentially like an alternative vision of education policy? And if so, how does that get implemented? I'm not asking necessarily for the answer. I'm just asking for sort of like a loose examination of that, perhaps.
Sure. Well, I mean, I know it's a sad moment, you know, like probably a lot of your listeners. I was a Bernie supporter. worked very hard to try and help him win the nomination. You know, and it's because of stuff like the way he has embraced this very dramatic shift in how we think about education, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that I support him. It's not about one person, right? I mean, the thing that Bernie has really been able to do is bring together a lot of the critiques that have been made from a lot of different quarters. So, I mean, there's no scenario in which, you know, that all those things that you mentioned aren't driven by the stuff that we've seen from grassroots, member-driven teacher union efforts over the past decade, right? Mm-hmm. Starting with the CTU, but lots of other unions are doing it too. I mean, the St. Paul teachers have been, you know, kind of on the cusp of that as well. We've seen it in LA, you know, even the red state teacher strikes, which, you know, we're still thinking about what the sort of institutional legacy of those strikes are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, being able to basically make the argument that, like, we don't have to just accept it when conservatives tell us there's not enough money for kids to have good education.
Right.
So I mean, I do think that, you know, that sort of bipartisan consensus around, you know, market-driven education reform, it's becoming undone. And it's becoming undone because, you know, people have organized to try and make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, there's a real kind of, I'll use a fancy word here, but I really just want to use it to talk about the fact that there's really a relationship between these two things. There really is sort of like a dialectic
mm-hmm.
between like the Bernie campaign and the teacher union movement, right? And
mm-hmm.
you mentioned that you talked to Eric Blanc. Eric talks about this in his book, you know, where he basically points out that a lot of the, you know, sort of red state teacher strikes, particularly in, say, West Virginia and Arizona,
mm-hmm.
were people that had been involved with the Bernie campaign,
right?
And that the Bernie campaign of 2016 had basically kind of inspired people to realize that there are different ways of doing this, right? There are new ways to frame education.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think, like, even though Bernie has lost, we've built a critical mass in this country. Now we have to, between Bernie and the social movement teacher unions that are out there, we have to think about how we carry that forward. And that's really, you know, the question of the day. And I don't mm-hmm. know what that looks like. And it doesn't make me any happier about the fact that, you know, our choice in this election is basically a neoliberal Democrat and mm-hmm. a monster. But, but I think we can be encouraged by what we've achieved. Now, I will say this, you know, one of the things that I would actually say that Bernie could have gone even further. And this is something that we need to think more about. So when we need to think about what it is that education means. And, you know, I still think even from some of the things that Bernie said about education, you know, there was a little bit of kind of accepting the idea that education is critical for people to get good jobs.
Right.
That, you know, we've got to educate people because they've got to compete in this, like, you know, global marketplace of jobs. I'm an educator, right? Of course, I think, you know, access to education is important. And I know that, you know, people need education to succeed in the job market.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to disaggregate those things. We need to talk about them separately. We need to talk about how we can guarantee people economic livelihoods in a way that's not connected to the grades that they get in school. And we also need to think about the education system as being something that's about more than just preparing people for jobs.
Yeah.
It's completely worthwhile to invest in public education all the way up from kindergarten, pre-K, kindergarten, all the way up through college as something that helps people, that enables people to not just get good jobs, but be good citizens and to have better lives. And until we think about the education system as serving that function, you know, I don't think we're going to fully be able to break away from the circles of education reform that are dragging us down.
Yeah, that's a really great point, especially when you consider, like, when the whole Common Core thing came up. It was the Common Core standards for, you know, college and career, you know, these sorts of things that are framing education, the entire sort of reason that exists. Like, I'm just basically repeating what you said, but I think it's worth that, just sort of like this entire frame of education as being a preparation for the world. Now, I do think that there is a place for, I mean, that is a part of it. It's a factor, I suppose. And especially the, like, if you can kind of break it away from the college aspect, if you can get more especially if it's represented by the sort of craft unions and things like that. That could be something that could sort of change at least that specific limited trajectory and focus on college. But yeah, the general focus on education being the key to the rest of your life is, it makes it a pretty big matzo ball, you know, to speak in Seinfeld terms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it, yeah, go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Follow up.
Well, and I mean, I was just going to say that, like, what that does, if that becomes your only argument for how people have good lives, mm-hmm. is it doesn't recognize all of the other things that are happening. It doesn't recognize, you know, like, and this is why I'm so appreciative of the work that some of these teacher unions like CTU and in LA have been doing, is, you know, recognizing that there are, even if we did have this system where, you know, education basically equated to how you do in the job market, we know that it doesn't. There's all these other things that exist. But even if it did do that, that people are coming from places where they're dealing with trauma in their lives, you know, they're dealing with lack of food and housing insecurity. And how on earth can you expect them to compete, you know, with people who, you know, are growing up, you know, in a suburban neighborhood with every privilege, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, so we have to think about it beyond that, those very narrow confines, I guess. I'm sort of agreeing with you now, but
yeah, that's okay. That I like being agreed with. one final question, I suppose, and this sort of can kind of bring it back a bit to, it can kind of like thread the sort of Bernie education and sort of like the future needle. Especially at the national level, during the presidential campaign, and then looking forward, the national level of the unions, especially in 2015-16, very quickly came out for Hillary Clinton. And that was yeah. not necessarily with a mandate for membership. It was sort of a decision that was viewed at least by members from the top. Now, I'm not asking this question to vilify unions. I'm a member of a teachers union, and I'm not necessarily saying I stand behind this decision, but I'm very careful in how I'm critical of these things as to not sort of like make an anti-union argument. Now, in 2016, there was a seemingly, or at least on its face, a more deliberative process. But eventually, at the end, when sort of the winner was decided, everybody lined up behind Joe Biden. Can that be read? Or, I guess it can be read as a rejection of the set of policy and issues that Bernie was putting forward, but I don't think it's that. How can we sort of like reconcile this as sort of people in these organizations, and how can we sort of make these entities perhaps more representative? And I'm not asking for the answer, but as kind of an examination, contextualize this, if you can, how can we sort of look at things that have happened in the past, if it exists, and sort of know, or at least have an indication of how to sort of react to that and behave to sort of change these dynamics, or at least,
yeah,
I don't know.
Sure. Well, yeah,
John,
no, that's a great question.
John, I mean, please solve unions for me.
If I could do that, man, I'd be out doing something else right now. but you know, I would start by saying, you know, we're both in the same union. I'm AFT as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were not happy with what happened in 2016.
Extremely.
You know, they felt like, I mean, you nailed it. I mean, the endorsement was made too soon. There was not nearly enough engagement with the grassroots. And, you know, I think the AFT National, there was clearly a tacit recognition of that from mm-hmm. how they did things this time around, which, mm-hmm. you know, I gotta be honest, I think they handled it incredibly well this time around. Mm-hmm. You know, giving locals the ability to endorse whomever they'd like. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that led to, you know, the LA teachers, the Chicago teachers endorsing Bernie. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that was the way to do it, giving local autonomy. And, you know, even at a certain point when I can't remember exactly when this was, but basically when AFT passed that resolution, the executive council, that said, you know, our members endorse, we encourage you to get involved for Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, or Joe Biden, right? Because those are the three people that we, you know, see as, you know, winners here, basically. From what I understand, I mean, I think the methodology there was using a lot of internal polling. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that, you know, as a Bernie supporter, you know, I know that in particular in Wisconsin, I think, and this is something we have to get into some other time, but mm-hmm. you know, because of what's happened to unions in Wisconsin, the people who are members right now tend to be further left than probably in a lot of other states, mm-hmm. right? Because most of us are here because we have real ideological commitments. But it would have been split pretty significantly between Bernie and Warren. And that was not a fight that I went to get in either my local or, you know, because then, you know, you take your mind, you take your eyes off of all the stuff that's happening locally that needs to get done.
Correct.
And you have people, you know, fighting over that situation. So, I think things were handled pretty well this time around, and there was much, you know, basically, like, I think, you know, there's a tacit recognition of that things had not worked well in 2016. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't solve the dilemma, right?
Right.
I think, you know, it's tragic that more unions didn't come out for Bernie right now, because mm-hmm. he's the only candidate that clearly understood the place that the labor movement is going, that has to play in democratizing our society.
Right.
I mean, Biden's got some union support, of course, for example, and Warren, you know, is a populist, but I think, you know, one of my friends described it this way, and I think it's a really good way of looking at it. She's more of the sort of progressive consumer activist, whereas Bernie mm-hmm. is sort of the, you know, working class, you know, labor driven sort of activist. And
critically, Warren is a political loner in a very real way. That Sanders.
Bernie said from the get-go that, like, I can't do this by myself. Mm-hmm. Every time people asked him how he was going to persuade a Republican Congress, he said, I can't. Like, I've got to have a grassroots movement behind mm-hmm. me. And so, you know, his plan for labor, you know, to double union members within a few years, to
card check,
you know, to basically give every public employee in this country, which would have been revolutionary in my state, right? Because we've lost meaningful collective bargaining rights, mm-hmm. to give every public employee the right to join a union and collectively bargain would have been mm-hmm. transformative. Mm-hmm. So I think mm-hmm. I think it's utterly tragic that he didn't win the nomination and didn't get support from you know, more Democrats. But you know, there's a lot of bigger issues with our political system, right? I mean, number right. one, money still plays a huge part in you know, who's donating to candidates. Mm-hmm. The media, you know, played a really important role in framing things in a way that made Biden seem to be the one who was, like, you know, most poised to beat Trump. And by the way, that came at the expense of Warren too. Mm-hmm. You know, she was hurt by that as well. Mm-hmm. So, so part of it is, like, you know, American politics. I don't know. Barack Obama used this metaphor to talk about something. I don't remember what it was, but it was basically like, you know, American politics are like an ocean liner, right? They get moving in one direction, and it takes an incredibly long time to turn them. And so I think, you know, so many of the kind of conventional assumptions that Americans had of Democrats about who could beat Trump, who is this monstrous entity who, you know, has threatens a lot of our civil liberties, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, there a lot of those assumptions still came down to, like, we've got to go with this, like, centrist who's mm-hmm. going to, you know, be non-threatening. So, you know, I don't know what to do going forward. I know that, you know, we're going to have to continue to deal with this dilemma. You know, I was talking to somebody about this yesterday, like, simply saying we're not going to vote for a Democrat in the absence of doing something else.
Right.
Right. That's not a plan.
That's
either.
A commitment,
you know,
to,
like,
that's a commitment to non-action.
It is. I mean, you know, so I'm not telling people whether they have to vote for Biden or not. I'm not going to make that argument. I think people need to vote their conscience. But you know, I don't think just saying, like, because there's this sort of argument out there, right, which is, like, if we just deprive the Democratic Party of votes, like, you know, there'll be this kind of, like, spontaneous shift in how the party works. That's not how anything works.
No.
Right? Like that's just giving up. So I know that if people are not going to vote for Biden, they need to come up with some other ideas, and they need to be, you know, getting to work every day, because, you know, just not voting for, you know, a Democrat that is, you know, further to the right than you like, is that's not the answer either.
Right. So. And it really is a difficult thing in terms specifically of, like, what do you do, you know, about this sort of situation? Because it is it's a huge dilemma in terms of just how inflexible our political system is, especially when it comes to, well, actually, it's very sort of on its feet, you know, flexible when it comes to reforms that would sort of, you know, accelerate the current status quo. But that's not I mean, I guess that's not something that's, you know, revolutionary even to say, but the idea that the system is so hostile to any sort of change that would sort of release that is really the way that I think we need to be thinking about this. Anyway,
that's right.
Would you did you want to talk about just your book one more time? Where can we get it? How can we also, what other projects are you involved with? And maybe like a Twitter or something if you're on there.
Sure. Yeah. So the book is called Teacher Strike: Public Education and the Making of a New American Political Order. You can get it. It came out from the University of Illinois Press. So you can get it there. You can also order it on the international conglomerate that shall not be named. you can order it there as well. I also have a chapter that just came out in a book called Labor Under Trump, Labor in the Time of Trump.
And so that
actually connects what's happened in Wisconsin to what's happened in the United States in terms of, like, basically explaining how we got to Trump. So that one's like hot off the presses. That's from Cornell University Press. You can check that out. Twitter handle is at Prof. Shelton. And I'm working on a new book right now that is tentatively titled Human Capital.
My two favorite words together.
Education. Exactly. It's meant to be critical, though.
Yeah, of course.
Human Capital, education and economic opportunity, and the roots of the 21st century political divide, very early on in that project. So that won't be out for a while, but if any of your listeners want to talk about that, feel free to get in touch with me.
Great. Well, thank you very much, John Shelton. I really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on Good Morning Comrade. You can listen to us every Tuesday on whivfm.org/listen. We also have several podcasts released. We are